Dove Creek, a novel read by the author Paula Coomer and brought to you by KRFP in Moscow, Idaho.
Mystery, mystery behind the veil, surprise me. Confound me. Surround me.
This is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either products of the author's imagination or used in a fictional way. Any resemblance to actual locales or persons, living or dead, is entirely coincidental.
Patricia has started work in earnest as a public health nurse on the reservation. She meets and gives care to a woman who reminds her of her Kentucky grandmother. First aid. South. A thing is only a thing. Toby Perez, Navajo, hoop dancer. May 23rd, 2001, Eagle Cap Wilderness, Oregon. That first Christmas was hell, but I sucked it up and willed it not be. Drove up the Clearwater River on a crisp, foggy Saturday midway into December to a tree farm, armed with axe, saw, a ball of twine, and two gangly sons. We took turns chopping and sawing, losing and retrieving mittens and hats, our moon boots mucking straw-covered ground into brick batter, and managed to hack down our own tree. Foam cups of hot chocolate with marshmallows for $1 each, bulk packaged gingerbread men for free. It also took the three of us to heft 7 feet of our well-debated blue spruce trunk and limbs to the top of our new Honda Civic, crisscrossing lines sufficient to withstand the 55 miles per hour drive back to Lewiston. Who knows how we looked to the rest of the dutiful moms and dads clapping their hands against the cold, and to the world speeding past with red and green holiday passion, but I felt like hot pink neon announced my life's verdict and sentencing, 30-something single mother, doomed to spend eternity alone. Once home with the tree, we opened boxes marked Christmas stuff to the sights and smells of blind safety and comfort. Christmas the year prior, we'd stretched a 10-foot spruce between carpet and plaster ceiling in the living room of our craftsman-style home. The cranberry candles in gem-cut glass jelly jars sitting in the windows, the fire in the brick fireplace, in summer a perfect grotto for a large antique basket full of dried flowers, cedar boughs and cherub faces lining the rough beam mantle, stockings loose but full of possibility. The red and green plaid ribbon I braided with strings of gold beads and grocery bag paper twists to make length after length of garland. I also made the angel to perch at treetop out of a version of paper twists meant to look like corn husks, hair a bit of moss, arms stuffed with batting and holding a bouquet of red roses, wings gold and bright as mica, made from the same strange handicraft material that comes twisted and crinkled until you dampen it, open it, and understand its dormant state as actually something pliable. And from other earlier Christmases, ceramic ornaments painted in detail and glazed in 1985, the year little boys with chicken pox proved to be just as challenging as the start of a nursing career. Weird paper cutouts from preschool and kindergarten, Rudolph, Santa Claus, a red and green paper chain, a brown thing Zach insisted was another reindeer, the plastic canvas needlepoint squares they stitched from a kit in 1988, salt dough candy canes, snowmen, molds of child-sized hands, a group of stale potato chips residing inexplicably with a forgotten collection of fractured crystal ornaments. I tried to glue a broken angel, but the pieces did not stick. And so a marvel when my gift from Zach was an angel just like her. "Cool," he said, when I pointed out the severed head of the old one, hanging like a prim ball from the Christmas tree. Brett and Zach were scheduled to spend Christmas with Mark and Tanya, so we planned our celebration for the Friday night before I was to drive them over a winterized version of Rattlesnake Canyon and Snow Hollow Hill, which was slick and frightening, prone to drifts and icing over, to rendezvous with Mark and Tanya and her kids at the Dairy Queen in Enterprise. I made a full course turkey dinner with homemade breads for stuffing, caramelized yams and pumpkin pies, banana bread for dessert, after which we unwrapped presents. Zach had the angel for me. Brett bought me a journal. My gifts for them were more practical than I wanted to be, but we had just moved again, so the money was tight. After a month in temporary housing on Highway 3 along the Potlatch River, 25 miles north of Lapway, in two different rentals in two weird little side-by-side towns called Kendrick and Julietta, the market finally broke in Lewiston. I had but one charge card and bought what I thought I could afford to repay, a new set of tubular steel bunk beds from J.C. Penney, painted royal blue, a full bed on the bottom with an end ladder climbing to the twin on top, to replace the bulky wooden one someone had made by hand and discarded in a yard sale. Also from Penny's, new sheet sets and comforters printed with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and enough Legos to make both boys exclaim and tell me how much they love me, to add to the bucketful they already had. They'd built a cardboard space station in the corner. All the rocket ships and launch pads were made from Legos, sized to hold their Teenage Mutant Turtle figurines. They had a 1950s Erector set, also a yard sale find, for the loftier, more intricate parts of the space station. I still hadn't bought a television, so they exercised their imaginations the old-fashioned way, by making up and making do. Once in a while, somebody's arch-enemy destroyed the space station and they began anew, which usually coincided with my having emptied another cardboard box, so there was much rebuilding, a fresh slate, another town, a new beginning. It is Mother's Day weekend, 1992, our first one without Mark, who usually bought me long-stemmed roses from the Rotary Club. I have rented a Forest Service cabin up the mountain from Elk City, Idaho, $15 a night, in order to spend undivided time with Brett and Zach. The road is long, winding between leafed canyons, under cliff-to-cliff train trestles. The history of massive wooden beams charted by solemn signs that tempt us to pull into wide spots, read goosenecked and squinting through the Civic's gnat-coated windows. This spring has proven one thing. Idaho is a land of bugs. We drive southeast on Highway 95 past the town of Winchester and Winchester Lake State Park, the last still water before crossing the Camas Prairie, then to Grangeville, where we are lured by a silkscreen shop signage. Brett and Zach make friends with the graphic designer while I try on black leggings and a long black sweatshirt, the front dripping with silver and gold sparkling paints. The designer offers me strange flat donut-shaped earrings upholstered in metal flake gold vinyl for half price, asks if we are headed to Skookumchuck. I tell her no, we are new to the area. We're new to everything. Brett and Zach choose sweatshirts with wildlife silk screens. By the time we get back to the car, I am minus 150 federal payroll dollars. We take Highway 14 along the sparkly South Fork of the Clearwater River into the Clearwater Mountains, past the villages of Mount Idaho and Golden, to one named Elk City. Then south on a lesser road, new asphalt clogging potholes in older, harder pavement, to an outpost known as Dixie, where we stop at a roughneck restaurant and bar for a break. The air outside and in smells of reheated cooking oil, both old and new cigarette smoke. Two bellied men in logo hats and suspenders and jeans ignore us, chat loudly over coffee about hippie activism, about idiots driving spikes into old-growth trees, work-thickened, dark-nailed hands rising to accentuate their convictions. Dear stomach. I worry my early 20s voluntarily homeless and working as a fruit picker for the anti-establishment adventure outshines my yuppie accoutrements. We use the restrooms, get our sodas in red Coca-Cola to-go cups. Some people might think it's risky to haul a pair of boys so young to a place far from emergency aid, far from a phone, far from anything familiar, and indeed I had to change a flat tire the next morning. But we were used to such things. Mark and his brother's elk hunting camps in the Wenaha Toucanon Wilderness of northern Oregon or the Strawberry Mountains further south, fishing on the desert flanks of the Snake River at a brief place called Huntington. Earlier, the remote forks of the North Saniam River, the Deschutes, the John Day, the Malheur, the Minum, the Grand Ron. Then, of course, there was the time I lived as a vagrant, surviving 2 years on the American road with my first husband, Jeff, after which I dashed home to Kentucky and Indiana to collect the whole of what I owned, a few sets of embroidered blue jeans and gauze blouses, a Bible, Carole King's tapestry album, a copy of Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, a few notepads, a few pieces of exotic velveteen I found in San Francisco, into a $14 Kmart footlocker, booked a ticket on the Greyhound, and headed back across the plains and the Rocky Mountains and the Cascades to the Willamette Valley of Oregon. From a childhood of hills and hardwoods, sumac, poison oak, mayapple, and jack-in-the-pulpit, to ponderosas and pinus contortus, monster white pine, Douglas fir, larch, mammoth cedar, and an undergrowth of ferns, all because I met a blonde-haired poet named Kevin the summer before, whose father was a mechanic on a mint farm at Marion outside Salem. Kevin drove an old snub-nosed pickup truck back and forth to the mint mill. His mother canned vegetables. Sisters nursed crushes on the other laborers, struggled to get their schoolwork done. Young men of wisdom, old men of dreams, lines from a scrawled poem Kevin gave me. I had no money save the medical settlement I got in the sixth grade when I crossed the path of a one-ton pickup in front of my house and it sent me flopping, crushing my skull against the gravel parking strip Daddy built over the top of a patch of tall grass too inconvenient to mow. We didn't have too many dead cars then, only the 39 Ford coupe down in the garage and an old shell of a Studebaker pickup he'd eventually fill with the engine and transmission out of a Chrysler New Yorker and paint orange. Kevin's poems were like a homing device. My first marriage to the born-again hippie Jesus freak Jeff, the one whose broad shoulders were enough to make me want to say I do, ended not because of Kevin, but in spite of Kevin's efforts to talk me into sticking it out. I rode the bus all the way to Salem and rented a car with that money. I took a job on the night shift pulling bruised beans and toothless corn cobs and dead mice from a cannery belt, and lived in the attic of the farmhouse where Kevin's family squatted. The motion of the conveyor belt was nauseating, and working the graveyard shift made me an insomniac, so Kevin and I decided to try a community college. We were going to be foresters. We signed up for algebra and intro to forestry. But then I took an apartment with carpet on the floor and no furniture across from the bowling alley in a town called Staten, and took a job as a waitress in a pizza restaurant where Mark was manager. Kevin's expression still haunts me, the one he wore when I showed up late for classes and said, "I'm leaving school to spend time with Mark." His blonde head and hazel eyes staring straight ahead, the faintly red mouth not speaking, the smell of horsehair upholstery and dusty floorboards rising out of the pickup cab, the flower perfume of bruised mint, the sound of the old truck's cylinders clacking, the pop of the universal joint when he dropped his work boot on the clutch and shifted into reverse. I met a man named Kevin on the train from Spokane to Chicago last winter. Everything would be different except a girl broke his heart at 20. He drank too much. He'd bought a new pair of hiking boots because he used to love to hike. Left his children and ex-life in California to marry Savannah in Indiana, who was into New Age magic and mysticism and loved country music radio. The last part of the trip is on burnished dirt and crushed pumice, a Forest Service road that carries us from the Pacific time zone into mountain time, an Idaho oddity separating north from south by the hours on a clock. Losing that hour could be a depressing thing. Imagine if you don't turn around and head north again to retrieve it, an hour of your life is gone. But mountain air and freedom and the fact that I did this myself, called the Forest Service and taught myself to read a topo map, makes it worth it. The cabin is not log as I expected, but board and batten. Gray paint gone grayer. 10 window screens torn in places and patched, retacked in others, giving the place a Depression-era look and feel. These are the Salmon Mountains, where Chamberlain Creek empties into the South Fork of the Salmon River. We have no rules for the weekend. I have abolished our usual standards of behavior. We may eat at will from the cooler and grocery sacks, only sworn to save the marshmallows, Hershey bars, and graham crackers for late-night s'mores. I have 2 bottles of Chardonnay. I give license to all language, even vulgarities, which thrills Brett and Zach. We have declared bathing and washing dishes optional. We will stay up all night if we want. I am in charge of the fire. Brett and Zach will chop kindling. The Forest Service provided an axe to match the one we brought and a pile of split logs. Red fire extinguishers and smoke alarms hang in strategic places. I step through the rusted screen door, eyeing them gratefully. Grateful, too, for the emergency drill and fire extinguisher training Moose staged for Indian Health Service employees the previous week. Keep a clear head, pull the metal pin, aim, and fire. Try not to breathe the smoke. I shake off images of my son's gangly pre-adolescent limbs, loose and charred, like dead concentration camp babies. Shake off the images of an ashen life, the hollow years, if I were to survive, losing them. I hear Brett yell, his voice teetering between croaking and maturity, the vulgarity jarring me. And how practiced and slick it fell from his lips. Pine boards wind to my footsteps, follow me to the scent of camp mattresses. 2 minimal bedrooms, a pair of metal cots in each. The argument is over who has to sleep in the same room as Mom, who gets a room to himself. No thought given, apparently, to Mom being awarded the single room, and I say as much. Brett's arms are crossed against his chest, lips pouting, puffy. Zach wages on, directing the air with his arms, his words, as always, nearly visible with italics, paving the space between him and his brother with well-articulated argument. "You got the front seat," Brett says, dropping to the bed, "so I should get my own bedroom." "Work it out, you two," I tell them. I am determined. The days will have no boundaries. They will learn from their battles. If they exhaust themselves, they'll find peace and sleep. If they'll kill each other, I'll die explaining why I gave them this freedom. It is the same reason I plucked us from our lives and deposited us on the Nez Perce Reservation. It is because I want them to know there is more than one way. I want them to know release from authority, to know how it feels to self-govern. Or is the release I crave mine? And I can't begin to perceive the long winding effects of this weekend, that 13 years later, the night before Brett stands in a Catholic church in Moscow, Idaho, in a black tuxedo, and passes a diamond-studded wedding band to a beautiful woman, the two will get drunk at the bachelor party and end in fisticuffs, screaming threats and ancient accusations, Brett in the end dropping to the ground sopping with tears of frustration and loss. Walking back into the cabin's kitchen, I glimpse the long hallway to this future but cannot put language to it. What I hear instead are the words of Leonard Wohoban, "Your sons will turn out fine because they are yours."
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek.
All the oxen free, come out from behind the tree. You and I were meant to be.
Patricia and her sons celebrate their first Christmas and subsequently Mother's Day together. Patricia remembers her first marriage to Jeff and a boyfriend named Kevin. I leave their brotherly courtroom and return to the car for more trappings. We have 2 new Kmart sleeping bags, $19.99 worth of Dacron batting, cotton duck exterior, plaid flannel lining, and my own lined with printed hunting scenes, the one Mark bought me for Mother's Day, 1980, during the second trimester of my pregnancy with Brett. I try to recall whether that was before or after Mount St. Helens erupted. Feeble memory looking to the mountains for clues. And then, a change. What is this? Something in the air shifts, becomes unstable. Is it a warning? Has a cougar moved into the periphery? Whatever is at work pries me into the moment. It feels stark, sparkling with metallic glimmer and chill, the relief of trees limbering up after winter sleeps in high light breezes, the grace of the creek with the sound of its tinkling music rushing at the speed of my blood, full of volume, but at the same time quaint and silent. I glimpse the knowing that I am the only being standing on this spot of Idaho, the only witness to these small drifts of snow tossed against enormous trunk bases, stoic in their right to be ice in the presence of heat in this wilderness of life and survival. I am the only one who smells ponderosa, spruce, larch, lingering exhaust from unleaded fuel, a stopped engine. I am the only one who can walk along the creek until night brings dark and frost, and the cold bids me sit and sit and sit until I've lost the desire to turn back. Ellen Barton was my friend and commanding officer and had raised two sons on her own. By the time I met her, she was in her mid-40s and just promoted to captain. She was a pioneer in Idaho public health and the first nurse practitioner on the Coeur d'Alene Reservation, where I was to be eventually stationed. Ellen and I liked to go to lunch at Jack Spur, a 40s-style diner east of Lapway on Highway 95. We sat in vinyl booths, ate Reuben sandwiches, French fries, afterwards a York mint. Ellen was a closet Trekkie who kept in her office a life-sized cardboard figure of Dr. Bones McCoy I bought for her one Christmas. It was a month before the Mother's Day weekend at the cabin. Brett and Zach and I were living in the duplex in Lewiston on Larkspur Drive. It sat high above the Snake River in a newer development not far from the Elks Club. The word Larkspur made me homesick for my old wildflower hobby, Arctostaphylus uva ursi, Taraxacum officinalis, Microsteris gracilis. Ellen had just spent a weekend babysitting my boys while I was in Seattle at a conference, during which she taught them to play poker and brought them home with tattoos on their deltoids. Water soluble, but tattoos nonetheless. Which may or may not have damaged them, but fit into the schematic of our developing troubles. Brett was smoking cigarettes, hanging with a group of boys who smelled bad and was putting on pounds so quickly that for the first time I was buying jeans according to waist instead of length. Zach, his body strength heightened by the hours he spent with me in the gym, had tackled a 3-year-old neighbor and broken the boy's arm. He'd bloodied several more noses on the playground. Either the principal or Zach's teacher or counselor called every day. "Is anything wrong at home?" they all asked. I don't know. Did zooming 150 miles 2 weekends a month over a road called Rattlesnake constitute something being wrong? Did Mark setting up house with his blonde police trainee constitute something being wrong? Did Brett and Zach changing schools 3 times in 1 semester constitute something being wrong? Ellen insisted I counsel with Leonard Wahobin, take advantage of his experience as a parent and spiritual elder. "But I've already talked to Moose," I said. "You need it," she said, "not just your boys, but for you too." Leonard's desk sat against the other side of the room from mine, facing the back of the particle board bookshelves that divided us. His part of the space was the hub for patient education, 2 of the walls lined with gray metal shelves bent and heaving from the weight of cardboard boxes full of government-issue pamphlets, articles, videos, posters, and untold pilferings from conferences, powwows, gatherings. Leonard was tall, lean, and even in his early 50s, still an Indian country basketball star. He stabbed something new onto his bulletin board every week or so, most recently the original of the now months-old Christmas photocopy some of us had received, a picture of Leonard in full regalia, face streaked red, black, and white, sticking out his tongue. He held a master's degree in visual art. Some of his paintings hung on the wall around his desk. They were fluid motions of color and pattern, blues, greens, oranges, and yellows. When I was alone in our office, I sometimes walked to his side to stare at them. He called me Rumi. I called him Lautiwa, friend. The guys in pharmacy called me his nemesis, goddess of divine retribution. One morning we were preparing a presentation for various tribal agencies about exercise. Leonard was helping me with the promotion and record keeping for a community fitness event known as the 100 Mile Club, a brainchild of the Zuni tribe in New Mexico, whereby participants were required to walk or run 100 miles in 16 weeks, hopefully, in part, as preparation to send a Nez Perce delegation to an annual runners event called Bloom's Day in Spokane. I was, at the time, a proselyte for health, determined to convert the whole tribe to the religious benefits of weightlifting, power walking, vegetarianism, and recycling. So much that when the clinic staff voted to requisition vending machines for the basement, I was not allowed on the selection committee. "You'll want to put falafels in," Brenda Henry, my good buddy and one of the dental assistants, told me, referring to the Halloween potluck for which I had made and brought that very thing. Our instruction was fraught with ominous undertones. The North Idaho Service Unit of the Indian Health Service had the highest rate of diabetes-related amputations of any Northwest tribe. Only recently had the Indian Health Service agreed to fund a podiatrist to hold foot care clinics and to allocate money for special shoes to encourage tribal members to pay attention to their feet. Glucose-laden blood corrupts nerve endings in the extremities, and so people suffer a loss of sensation. One woman with gangrene was harboring a thumbtack in her sole and did not recall having stepped on it. Wearing shoes did not seem important to her, since she could not feel her lower limbs. She was dear to Ellen, and, as Ellen put it, the last BKA, or below-the-knee amputation, this reservation is going to see. Understanding the how of diabetes was easier than understanding the why of its magnitude among Indian people. The highest rates nationally were among the Pima and Navajo. Most diabetes among Indians is adult onset. The single greatest risk factor is obesity, which is epidemic on reservations. The theory in 1992 was that Indians are hunter-gatherers. 60 or 70 years isn't enough to reprogram a genotype. Indian bodies are accustomed to operating efficiently enough to require smaller amounts of food when stores are low in winter, and to laying on adipose during late summer and early fall when quantities are plenty. It doesn't take too many calories to walk to Valley Foods and buy a bag of potatoes. And then there are simple sugars and the huge corporate promotion on Indian reservations and at powwows of Pepsi and Coke, and the harvest of plenty provided by the feds in the form of commodities, sugar and oil, fortified peanut butter, pork and beans, fruit cocktail in heavy syrup, Spam, processed cheese, high-calorie dried foods like figs, cake mixes, chocolate drink mix. And then I considered all the antibiotics. Every time I'd taken an antibiotic, I'd developed a yeast infection. By 1995, I had taken so many antibiotics for sinus infections that turned out to be the sequelae of an undiagnosed allergy to cow's milk and soy, I had to be hospitalized for systemic yeast. I had yeast growing in my blood and lungs. It took 2 years of powerful antifungals to recover, and I still occasionally require treatment. When I catch even the simplest of colds, I'm in bed for a week. My immune system reacts that violently. I don't dare take an antibiotic. Yeast overgrowth is known to be related to autoimmune diseases such as lupus, multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, all of which are epidemic among the tribes of the inland Northwest. What was going on in those Indian bloodstreams whose protective microorganisms had been clear-cut and whose diet was laden with simple sugars? Yeast and sugar make alcohol. In Japan, they call it maitaisho, or drunk disease, because sufferers have so much yeast in their intestines that any sugar immediately ferments. They behave like raging drunks even though they've not touched alcohol. At the height of my illness, one drink of liquor would send me sprawling. The same phenomenon is observed in nursing homes, where people are given antibiotics for diseases such as staph and strep, inherent to people in closed places. I talked about these things with Leonard as we drove from agency to agency, and about my growing understanding of how difficult displacement is, how its misery carries an exponent relative to an entire population of people, how plants, insects, and certain species of animals thrive only in their native habitats, and how hard science works to keep organisms from displacing themselves. "Look at whales," I said. "Look at the way people work so hard to get them back in the water when they beach themselves." Leonard didn't respond to my question, but asked me who I was dating. He thought he'd seen me as a passenger in a blue Miata. "One of our staff members drove a blue Miata," he mused. I asked frankly, "Well, what am I supposed to do, stay at home every night?" Then I told him what Mike Flanagan, our white-haired social worker, had said to me. He had seen me too and said, "When I first saw that car, I thought, there's no room for her children." Leonard took his moment to consider, then surprised me by inviting us to the tribe's annual root feast, held the next Sunday. The ritual was meant to herald change in the form of the coming of spring. "Your boys are going to turn out all right," he said again. "It may take time, but they will, because they're yours." When the day arrived 3 weeks later, I loaded Brett and Zach against their wishes into our shiny white Civic, which bore the badge of spilt red soda on the passenger side front floor mat, thanks to an accident Brett had on one of our trips over the mountain to spend time with Mark. A sorry reminder of the verbal rage of which I'd become capable. "I paid $70 for those mats." By then, Zach had vandalized a Lewiston School District school bus, punctured the back of one of its green vinyl seats with a screwdriver he stole from home, told his counselor and principal he felt like he was trying to poke his way out of a Ziploc baggie. I listened to the early morning calls at my desk, first from his teacher, then the school counselor, then his principal, reminded of my mother's stepfather who drove a long yellow school bus in Adair County. It was parked in the grass near their tar paper shack on weekends. My youngest aunt, my mother's sister Janet, and I once sat in the dusty heat of it, writing the words to all the Beatles songs in pencil on her lined composition books. My good friend Toby Perez, who was also a mental health social worker, also a hoop dancer and the father of six, stopped by my office one morning, and when I told him about the school bus, merely shrugged his shoulders and said, "You know, a thing is only a thing." And so we drove across the bridge toward the Potlatch Mill and the reservation in bright sunlight. The temperature was in the 70s, the pink surprise of dogwood everywhere, barren canyon walls now royal green, the Snake and Clearwater rivers flickering silver to white, fully serviced with runoff from snowmelt tributaries. Zach buckled in the front seat, Brett in the back. We had a fresh system to avoid the who gets the front battle. Each boy had front seat privileges for a week at a time. It was the last day of Zach's turn. Both boys had consistently refused to attend tribal events, refused the Christmas powwow, the teepee setting at the Nez Perce Museum at Spalding, the Looking Glass powwow at Kamiai. Zach and I had just that week begun counseling together with Toby Perez, off the record. I would not be allowed to receive services from the IHS until my commissioning as an officer went into effect. A gentle, funny man with bright teeth and a spontaneous giggle with whom Zach professed an immediate attachment. Toby said he saw his own young penchant for drama in Zach, gave him his phone number, encouraged him to attend the root feast, counseled me on developing routines and rituals for my sons. What I wanted was to draw a police outline around myself, draft a flow chart so I could know my values. What was important? I considered laying us down on meat paper, tracing our outline with a magic marker so we could see ourselves again, so we could have the feeling of rising from that place. I thought of this day again in April 1994, when 2 weeks after I transferred to the Coeur d'Alene Reservation, I received word that Toby Perez had been killed in a head-on collision at Lawyers Canyon north of Whiteburn on Highway 95. He was trying to get back from Salt Lake City to catch up on patient charts. One of the last things he told me was that he'd been arguing with his wife over wanting to leave the Mormon Church, returning to his traditional spiritual ways, and growing his hair long. In a poem I wrote for his funeral, I told him that, "Grow your hair long. The root feast was at the Paniwas, the large brick building where powwows, giveaways, basketball games, fairs, and veterans activities were held. We arrived to find the parking lot full, cars and trucks twinkling and wavering in the early heat. Dust departed here and there in brief, low puffs. Indian people funneled into the opening and closing doorway. Men in calico ribbon shirts and hats with feathers jutting from beaded bands, women in buckskin dresses, cotton skirts, fringe shawls. The drumbeat swelled each time the door opened. Inside, in the center of the gymnasium, two long lines of tables cloaked in white ran parallel to each other. Against the east wall, more tables heaved with steaming pots, huge stainless steel bowls, shiny square food warming trays, jewel-toned jello, square chocolate frosted cakes, round crust-covered pies set off to themselves, guarded by teenage girls with fur strips interlacing long braided hair, beaded moccasins on their feet. Smells of roasted meat, smoked fish, boiled potatoes, and cooked huckleberries stimulated the nerve endings in my nose, firing desire into my stomach. Immediately I felt hunger pangs where there had been none. Drummers moved to circle the drum, adding first rhythm, then voices to the solitary beat. Peripheral chatting gave way to a high-pitched chant. Ay-ya, ay-ya, ay-ya. I saw a doughty kicking woman. She motioned me toward a metal chair amidst a group of my elder women clients. The men, she said, have to sit over there, lobbing a brown arm toward the other table. Barry Atkins, our lanky lab tech who liked to wear commissioned officer work khakis instead of a lab coat and who made a palatable homemade beer, sat just opposite us on the other side of the room next to Joe McDonald, our dentist from the Menominee tribe of Wisconsin, whose wife, Melanie, made the best brownies I've ever tasted and housed Brett and Zach when Daddy had his heart attack and I had to rush home. I still have the hand-printed card she gave me with that recipe. I hustled Brett and Zach against protest in Barry's direction.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek.
All the oxen free, come out from behind the tree. You and I were meant to be. Beautiful to me.
Breath your soul.
You were always beautiful to me.
Breath your soul, mama.
Oh. Dove Creek was produced by Nancy Casey and Paula Coomer with help from KRFP, a listener-supported non-commercial radio station at 92.5 FM in Moscow, Idaho. You can find KRFP on the web at krfp.org, where you can click on Dove Creek to learn more about this broadcast, sign up for a podcast, or send an email. There you can also contact Bill Finch, who wrote and performs our theme song.